Welcome to The Bridge, a weekly magazine show featuring local and regional stories. I'm Kathleen Morgane, your host for the show. On Tuesday, Wyoming Governor Matt Mead toured the 416-acre Millennium Bulk Terminals coal export site in Longview, Washington. Wyoming is the top U.S. producer of coal, mining about 400 million tons of it annually. Mead is a proponent of U.S. coal exports and an active supporter of the proposed export terminal. Local feelings are mixed. Even those who would welcome the additional jobs are concerned about the export of a domestic resource, transportation gridlocks, and air quality.
We believe his coal should be kept in the ground in Wyoming. We don't want it here. We don't want it shipped to Asia, where it will be polluting skies in Asia, and then we'll blow back pollution and we'll be creating poisonous air for us.
Cassandra Profita reports on Governor Mead's visit to Longview coming up in about 9 minutes. NPR News headlines are next. The time is 9:01. You're listening to The Bridge on Coast Community Radio. I'm Kathleen Morgane. Almost immediately after the jubilant response to Sergeant Bo Bergdahl's release from the Taliban on Saturday, the story took a very different turn. First, there was criticism of the Obama administration exchanging 5 Taliban detainees for Bergdahl. Then some soldiers from his former unit started speaking out against the freed POW. Josh Cordor told CNN earlier this week that he believes men lost their lives searching for him.
I mean, he's at best a deserter and at worst a traitor.
As the Northwest News Network's Jessica Robinson reports, Bergdahl's hometown in Idaho was unprepared for the public backlash.
Jane Dressel owns an art supply store in downtown Haley, Idaho. For the last 5 years, she made sure the yellow ribbons for Bergdahl on all the trees on Main Street got replaced once they started to fade. Dressel says when the news of Bergdahl's release first came, for a while it was everything she had imagined.
Saturday and Sunday, everything was, you know, we were so surprised at the events that had happened, and it was just such a joyful, happy moment. And then after Sunday, there seemed to be a turn.
That turn came in the form of angry phone calls and emails, Facebook posts, tweets. People from across the country were incensed that the town would be celebrating Bergdahl's return. Right before I arrived for the interview with Dressel, her store had received its 11th angry call of the day. It wasn't yet noon. As the president of the local Chamber of Commerce, Dressel is helping with the welcome home celebration for Bergdahl at the end of the month.
I actually have some concerns about that now.
Like safety concerns?
I have safety concerns. I do. I've just never seen a turn of events happen so fast where you have such nasty remarks being made. I really am shocked.
People have called Bergdahl a traitor and a criminal who never should have been rescued. Those are some of the more PG comments. Some have vowed to come to Haley to demonstrate at the event. The mayor of Haley has responded with a statement asking people to withhold judgment until all the facts of the case are known. This was not the moment of triumph the town of 8,000 had been expecting. On Sunday, Bergdahl's father, Bob, thanked the community for their support over 5 long years.
The people in Haley, the Wood River Valley, you know, this little town in Idaho that was suddenly on the map.
Haley sits amid the foothills that grow into Idaho's Sawtooth Mountains. Bob and Jannie Bergdahl moved into one of the canyons here outside of town. They were off the grid for a time and homeschooled their kids Sky and Bo. Hiking trails on the sagebrush-covered hills were just minutes away.
You know, you'd see him out here on the trails and he was just head held high, smiling, walking, doing his thing.
That's Mark Lagulo. We're in Quigley Canyon, 3 miles from town. Lagulo's son Sean was friends with Bo when they were teenagers.
He's just a really good kid. His parents raised a really nice boy.
Some former members of Bergdahl's platoon have said Bergdahl mused about walking off into the similarly rugged hills of southeast Afghanistan. But Lagulo doesn't buy it.
No, I don't think so. Basically, this is a witch hunt. You know, old school, you know, ooh, you're guilty. Everyone says you are, so you must be. And only he knows what really happened.
If it turns out that back in June of 2009, he did walk off, would that change your perception?
No. I just think that we need to Let those that are in charge deal with it. And in the meantime, just accept someone home that has been lost for a while.
The military does have an ongoing investigation. Bergdahl is still undergoing medical treatment in a military hospital, but an Army spokesman says interviews with him about what happened will eventually be a part of their inquiry. Minna Kasser is a neighbor of the Bergdahls. I met up with her in downtown Haley.
He's one of our own here. We're very happy that he's coming home.
She says if Bo Bergdahl did leave the base, there's another important question.
Why was he that angry? And I don't think that has come surfaced yet at all. And I think that's something that we're going to have to wait and hear from him or from someone about what really caused him to do that.
Kasser's daughter and Bergdahl used to be in the same fencing club. She says whatever happened in Afghanistan, it was complicated.
I don't think we should have to choose between him being a quote-unquote hero or committing treason. I think that there's some middle ground there. And we have to understand what really went on.
It's unclear how long that will take. What is clear to some is that no soldier should be left behind on the battlefield.
He was listed by the Department of Defense as a POW, and that's all that mattered to us.
That's Ralph Kramer. He's the president of the Boise Valley POW-MIA Corporation and served in the Air Force for 2 decades.
We've been supporting Bob and Jenny since the very beginning as part of our mission. The POW mission is to make people aware and keep them aware. And our motto is never forget.
Kramer says every week the group has dedicated a couple of minutes to Bergdahl and kept a running tally of how many days he was missing. Kramer says he'll be at the welcome home celebration for Bergdahl at the end of June. As for the controversy surrounding Bergdahl's capture, Kramer says no comment. I'm Jessica Robinson reporting.
A controversial coal export terminal proposed for Longview, Washington, has a big supporter from the state of Wyoming. On Tuesday, Wyoming Governor Matt Meade toured the Millennium Bulk Terminal site with company executives who hope to ship coal from his state to new buyers in Asia. Cassandra Profita reports.
Millennium executives drove Meade around the former aluminum smelter in Longview. They explained how they're transforming the site into a facility that will take Wyoming coal off of trains and put it into export ships on the Columbia River. The project would export up to 44 million tons of coal a year. That might sound like a lot of coal, but Meade says it's just about 10% of what a state produces in a year. Last year, Wyoming produced more than 400 million tons of coal.
We are proud of that fact, and we want to see coal continue.
But what he calls unreasonable new regulations on coal-fired power plants in the U.S. are making it harder to expand coal markets here. Even before those rules came out, coal producers in his state had been looking for Asian buyers for all that Wyoming coal.
We've got to have a continuation in a real way, in an economical way, and so these companies can keep going. And exports are part of that future.
Companies hoping to be a part of that future have proposed a half dozen coal export terminals around the Northwest. The three proposals still under consideration face a long permitting process and strong local opposition. Meade says expanding the overseas coal trade with export terminals like Millennium will be good for the U.S. and its trading partners. But not everyone sees the benefits he does. Meade's visit sparked a protest from opponents of the Millennium Project. Outside the terminal site, about 30 people gathered with a bucket of coal.
This is coal that came from the Wyoming area, and we want to give it back to the governor.
Diane Dick is with the opponent group Landowners and Citizens for a Safe Community.
We believe his coal should be kept in the ground in Wyoming. We don't want it here. We don't want it shipped to Asia, where it will be polluting skies in Asia, and then we'll blow back pollution and we'll be creating poisonous air for us.
Meade also met with a group of Washington legislators in Longview. He says he wants to hear their concerns and help answer questions to build support for the Millennium Project. I'm Cassandra Profita in Longview, Washington.
On Tuesday, a Senate hearing in Washington, D.C. marked the legislative debut of an ambitious bill by Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden, meant to end, once and for all, the water wars in the Klamath Basin. From Jefferson Public Radio, Leah Moriarty reports.
Wyden presided over the hearing, which heard from representatives of Indian tribes and ranchers, as well as government agencies involved in hammering out the three agreements the bill would put into law. Wyden said the bill would end decades of conflict over water in the region that sprawls across the Oregon-California border.
The legislation, in my view, provides a sustainable and more economically certain future for the Klamath Basin.
The bill lays out a framework under which water would be allocated to ensure survival of endangered fish species. It promises irrigators less water than they've often had in the past, but greater certainty of how much they will get. Rancher Roger Nicholson said that should put irrigators' minds at ease.
With water assurances, we can take the water year and have some type of idea how much pasture we'll have, how many livestock you'll have, and you won't see the extremes anymore. Hopefully a complete shutdown, and so forth.
Several times in recent years, drought, combined with efforts to protect fish, has led to some irrigators being denied water for crops and livestock. A court decision last year awarded senior water rights in the system to the Klamath tribes and the federal government. That left irrigators holding a weak legal hand. After more than a decade of fighting, many decided, as one official put it, half of something is better than all of nothing. Rancher Becky Hyde noted her 14-year-old son Jack was in the hearing room.
An enactment of this legislation not only will help advance the economic interests of the region today, but will give Jack, if he chooses, and the next generation of family farmers and ranchers an opportunity to build a future in the area that we all call home.
Don Gentry, chairman of the Klamath Tribes, said the bill would assure the survival of the fish that are the traditional basis for the tribe's culture. And he said,
maintaining our traditional way of life, our spiritual and cultural practices is essential for providing for the physical and social health of our people.
All the speakers invited to testify at the hearing had nothing but praise for the bill and for the stakeholder process that produced the agreements it's based on. But those agreements are far from universally popular in Klamath country. The commissioners in Klamath County, Oregon, as well as the supervisors in Siskiyou County, California, are united in their opposition. They feel the agreements shortchange agriculture. They also oppose removal of four hydroelectric dams on the Klamath River that block fish migration. The Wyden bill leaves that decision up to the Secretary of the Interior. Even Indian tribes are divided on the bill. The Yurok and Hoopa tribes in California say the agreements fall short. Hoopa tribal attorney Tom Schlosser says the pacts prioritize water for Oregon irrigators at the expense of fish.
They do allow some water to flow into California, but it's just enough to satisfy the biological opinions to prevent extinction of coho salmon. It's not for restoration purposes.
Schlosser also says the bill would require the federal government to abandon its responsibilities to protect tribal rights, something Wyden says is not the case. Wyden's bill is co-sponsored by fellow Senate Democrats Jeff Merkley of Oregon and Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein of California. But even with that support, the measure has obstacles to overcome, not the least of which is its $500 million price tag over 10 years. That, plus the generally sour tone in Congress this election season, will make it a chore for Wyden to meet his deadline to get the bill to the president's desk by the end of the year.
You're listening to The Bridge here on Coast Community Radio, 91.9 KMUN Astoria and 89.5 KTCB Tillamook. I'm Kathleen Morgain. Still ahead, Pacific lamprey, a fish that resembles an eel, is sought out by native tribal members for ceremonial and personal use, but clashes have erupted over who regulates the catch, tribal or state agencies.
Now they've got folks on the reservation that won't even come down here because they're afraid that the enforcement's going to intimidate folks like they did in the past. Because I grew up living that way in the 70s, seeing the state policemen, you know, really treat the Indian folks really bad.
Tom Bonse reports on the recent and so far low-key fish war coming up just after this weather break. Here's the National Weather Service forecast for the Lower Columbia Coastal Region. Partly cloudy today with a slight chance of showers. Northwest winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. Highs in the upper 60s. Tonight, mostly clear with overnight lows around 50. You've no doubt heard people say they're going fishing. But how about going eeling, as in fishing for eel? For centuries, Native Americans from Boise to Wenatchee to southern Oregon have harvested Pacific lamprey, colloquially called eels. On Monday, the Warm Springs and Yakima tribes held a season-opening blessing ceremony at Willamette Falls. Correspondent Tom Bonsi reports the event happened against a backdrop of treaty rights tension over management of the dwindling fish.
Willamette Falls, just outside Portland, is one of the few places in the Northwest where it's possible and legal to catch Pacific lamprey for personal and ceremonial use. Tribal members are about the only ones who go for it. The ugly-looking critter resembles an eel, but it's actually a primitive fish with a distinctive toothy suction cup mouth. Eveline Pat is a Warm Springs council member. She says lamprey used to be a staple in the diets of Columbia and Snake River Basin tribes.
It's a rare treat now. It's getting to be a delicacy.
Pat compares lamprey to oysters. Others say it tastes like fishy steelhead. Pat is still spry enough to dance the eel dance. This happened during a blessing ceremony for the lamprey and fishermen held at the confluence of the Willamette and Clackamas Rivers. Tribal school children led a sort of conga line, more than 50 strong, of all ages. One of the fishermen here is Patrick Luke. He's a Yakima Nation biologist. Luke is still miffed about the ticket he received from Oregon Fish and Wildlife Police at the nearby falls in 2011.
Now they've got folks on the reservation that won't even come down here because they're afraid that the enforcement's going to intimidate folks like they did in the past. Because I grew up living that way in the 70s, seeing the state policemen, you know, really treat the Indian folks really bad.
3 years later, the Yakima Nation is still fighting Luke's ticket. Two other fishermen were also cited and had their catches seized that day for fishing without a state permit. The thing is, unlike salmon or game, Oregon does not recognize a treaty right to harvest lamprey. From the tribal point of view, they believe they shouldn't need the state's permission.
They don't set our seasons. We have our own law enforcement that sets our own seasons.
At Oregon's Department of Fish and Wildlife, fishery managers are trying to finesse the issue so it doesn't escalate. The department's Tony Nigros says his agency is trying to reach an understanding that at least clarifies the rules.
The state has its policies and its legal positions. They aren't necessarily in agreement at this point in time, but we respect and we recognize the differences. I think we've been fairly good at putting those differences aside, seeing if we can work cooperatively.
Nigro says Northwest states, tribes, and the federal government have a common goal to keep Pacific lamprey off the endangered list. Populations of the migratory fish have declined dramatically in recent decades. The reasons are many, including dams and water diversions. Both sides see room, though, for a limited ceremonial and subsistence harvest within a larger recovery effort. I'm Tom Bonsi in Oregon City.
The spring Chinook salmon fishing season is now underway in Oregon. A lot of Oregonians take salmon fishing seriously, but possibly none take it as seriously as the tribes of Grand Ronde, a group that has had a role in restoring the health of the fish that has become a symbol of the Northwest. Jacob Lewin reports.
In a way, the journey of some salmon starts here at Spirit Mountain, Oregon's biggest casino. Profits from the craps tables.
Four, the easy way.
And roulette wheels.
29 black odd.
Help fund fish and wildlife restoration. The member tribes of the Grand Ronde once covered an area stretching from northern California to western Washington. Salmon was abundant. Then came 1856.
The tribe was picked up off of all of their traditional lands, millions of acres, and force-marched onto a reservation in Grand Ronde.
Tribe spokeswoman Siobhan Taylor says in 1954, the tribe was terminated by the federal government.
One of the reasons they were terminated was because of the valuable resource that they had that other powers wanted, and that was timber. As a result of overly aggressive logging practices back then, habitat for our fish was decimated.
The tribe was restored by the federal government in 1983. Oregon's 8 Indian casinos are secretive about their profits, but an EcoNorthwest report says that as a group, they net about $142 million a year, of which 10% goes to resource management. Spirit Mountain is much more profitable than the average casino, but because of its relatively limited land area, a smaller percentage goes to resource management. Still, the Grand Ronde have spent millions of casino dollars in recent years on environmental protection. As tribe members see it, the improved health of salmon runs is helped by these dollars, that and prayer. Each May, when the salmon start running, Grand Ronde members travel to Willamette Falls near Oregon City, part of their historical lands, for the first fish ceremony. The tribe has also helped with habitat work on the Willamette. For them, the return of salmon is reverential. David Harrelson is a tribe historian.
Salmon are the life of the people, and it's said that if salmon cease to exist, the people will cease to exist.
The tribe takes just one fish, puts it on an open fire, and gives small pieces to everyone. Starting with just one allows more fish to return to their spawning grounds.
It's about acknowledging the salmon and taking care of them, honoring them and giving them respect. That's why we return the bones of fish to the river after we eat that fish.
25 miles east of Lincoln City, the waters of Agency Creek run fast and clear across a weir for counting fish on the reservation. The finishing touches are being put on a riparian restoration project to improve the creek and the South Yamhill River, where salmon spawn. 20 years ago, there were hardly any salmon here. Now, up to 1,000 return just to Agency Creek each year. Biologist Lindsay Belongi says the tribe chose a conservative way to restart the salmon cycle.
The only way we pursued how to do that was taking the approach of, if you build it, they will come. Restoring the habitat, placing large woody debris, having more conservative land management constraints on our lands to help improve that water quality.
Come fall, the Grand Ronde will be looking for salmon to return to Agency Creek.
Elders come down, tribal members come down, people come down on a daily basis to see if the fish have returned. And once the first fish is here, it's a community celebration.
Back at the casino, the economic driver for the rebuilding of the tribe, you might say, is where the journey of the salmon really ends.
And are you ready to order here?
I'll have the salmon.
Salmon Caesar salad or salmon fillet?
I'm Jacob Lewin in Grand Ronde.
Thank you. Would you like to add some soup to go along with that today?
Finally, tomorrow, June 6th, is the 70th anniversary of the Allied invasion of Western Europe. And this year's D-Day commemorations will be especially meaningful for World War II veterans in Oregon. The state's long-awaited World War II memorial opens tomorrow. Salem correspondent Chris Lehman spoke with one veteran of the conflict who plans to attend the dedication ceremony.
When Art Sorensen boarded a ship to Europe,
I knew this was the big one.
The Eastern Washington native fought with the 104th Infantry Division across France, Belgium, and Germany in the closing months of World War II.
Going into combat, our unit leader told me, he says, we're going to have heavy casualties. And we did. We had heavy casualties.
Sorensen is 92 years old now. After the war, he had a long career in the pharmaceutical industry and eventually settled in Lake Oswego, Oregon. His basement is a veritable museum of his time fighting the Nazis. One of his most cherished souvenirs, the actual helmet he wore into battle.
This is what we wore all the time. We wore it in combat. We slept in it. We shaved in it. We sat on it. We did about everything. This is our home in the war.
On the wall is a display filled with medals. There's a silver star, two bronze stars, and
that's the Purple Heart you get when you're either killed or wounded. Thank goodness I was only wounded.
Sorensen says he was hit in the head by pieces of a grenade. Medics patched him up, and he was quickly back on the front lines. But that wasn't even the toughest moment of the war for Sorensen. One time, he had the distinct feeling that his life was on the line.
When we were getting ready to move out, the captain shouted, fix bayonets. And I thought, oh, hell, this is going to be terrible. They don't fix bayonets unless it gets really bad.
And it did get bad. He and about 24 fellow soldiers were captured by the Germans and spent several days behind enemy lines. As the next battle intensified, they were herded into a bombed-out house and told to stay put.
We wondered when the German guards were going to come back and get us, because we had no weapons at that time, you know.
Their captors didn't come back, and after 3 days, Sorensen and his fellow soldiers made their way back to their own unit. You get the sense when you talk to Art Sorensen that he could tell you stories for days on end, but time is running short to hear firsthand tales of World War II. Nationally, hundreds of World War II vets die each day. The private foundation that's helping to create the Oregon Memorial estimates that more than 4,000 of the state's World War II vets have died since it started planning the monument 5 years ago. The group's Lou Jaffe says it's long overdue.
They deserve the honor. I mean, they really deserve to be honored for their service and for this time in our nation's history.
The memorial is on the grounds of the state capitol in Salem. It features a 33-foot-tall monument and granite walls with the names of the roughly 3,800 Oregonians who died in combat during World War II. Jaffe says the dedication ceremony itself will be an event to remember.
This will be the last large gathering of World War II veterans in the state, most likely. These folks are, the youngest of them are in their late 80s.
Many of the soldiers Art Sorensen served with are no longer living. He says the memorial has a purpose.
We need to educate our youngsters what this world had at that time and how we saved it.
But Sorensen says he doesn't think this time in our history will be forgotten. He says he recently spoke to a group of grade school students and was impressed at their interest and curiosity about his story. I'm Chris Lehman in Salem.
That's all the time we have for today's show. The Bridge airs weekly, Thursday mornings at 9. If you join the show late, you can listen to a podcast of the show from our website at coastradio.org. Just click the program box on the homepage. We welcome your comments on the show. Call us at 503-325-0010 or email to news1, that's NEWS, then the numeral 1, at KMUN.org. I'm Kathleen Morgane saying thank you for listening today, and listen in again next Thursday for the next edition of The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.